This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. When my guest, tennis legend Billie Jean King, captured the Wimbledon women's doubles title at the age of 17, she got a trophy and a chance to curtsy before the royal family, but no prize money. Today, that championship comes with hundreds of thousands of dollars in winnings, and a good part of the reason is Billie Jean King herself. When she was in her 20s, King organized other top women players in the game to take on the tennis establishment and win recognition and pay for their efforts, a high-risk undertaking that changed tennis forever. That's among the events King recounts in a new memoir, along with some of her 39 Grand Slam championships, her activism for women and LGBTQ rights, and some joyous and painful chapters in her personal life, including a closeted lesbian relationship that burst into public view with a lawsuit. Billie Jean King also co-founded World Team Tennis, and in 2009 was the first female athlete to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Her new book is All In, an autobiography. We're going to listen to a new interview I've just recorded with Billie Jean King, but first we'll begin with the event she's probably best known for, the so-called Battle of the Sexes match with self-proclaimed male chauvinist Bobby Riggs in 1973. King described the experience in an interview in 2013. Riggs, a former tennis champion, had challenged King to an exhibition match after defeating another women's tennis player, Margaret Court. King accepted, and the match was played in the Astrodome and seen by a TV audience estimated at 90 million people. We'll begin with an excerpt from an American Masters documentary about King. This deals with the hype leading up to the match. We'll hear King and Bobby Riggs talking to reporters, and at the end, a bit of Bobby on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
You know, I think that I can beat Bobby.
Well, what makes you think that I won't be able to psych you out of
it? I'm not Margaret Court. I love pressure. You can try to psych me all you want.
I think a lot's at stake for women's lib.
I like the idea that I'm playing for someone else besides myself.
I got 120,000 letters from Bobby's mob. This is the mob of guys all over the world who wrote and told me they were rooting for me. I wouldn't let these guys down for the world.
This is the atmosphere of a prize fight.
That's exactly what it is.
Oh, I mean, never bet against Bobby Riggs, especially when there's big money involved.
He hustles off the court and I hustle on the court, and that's what matters.
She's carrying a banner for the women's lib. I'm carrying male is supreme, the male is king, no matter what the difference in age.
This is a bunch of baloney. First of all, people are people, and some are more supreme than others in different things.
Do you like women?
I like them real good in the bedroom, the kitchen, and I really think...
You're a male chauvinist, eh?
And that is our guest, Billie Jean King, 40 years ago with Bobby Riggs before the famed tennis Battle of the Sexes in 1973. You obviously had a lot of joint appearances together with Bobby Riggs, building up the attention for the match. Did you feel like you got to know him at all?
Well, actually, Bobby was one of my heroes. I love history. I knew all the champions in our sport preceding me, and I appreciated him. He won the Triple Crown at Wimbledon. I knew that the Second World War had actually hurt his career, which I felt bad for him because it didn't allow him to get the recognition he deserved. He was finally at least getting recognition. I don't know. I don't think most people realized what a great champion he had been, even though I would tell them. I don't think they were really tuned in to that at the time.
Well, yeah, he was 55 when he was doing this thing.
He was as old as my father, and I told him for me to beat him meant absolutely nothing athletically, okay, nothing. But it's what it represented, and when Margaret lost, you know, I didn't know if I was going to beat him. I thought she would kill him and as far as winning, and she didn't. So I'm like, oh, boy. You never underestimate your opponent anyway. I mean, my parents, my dad, oh, God, that was like, he had two words. Always respect your opponent. Always, always, always respect them, no matter what. And secondly, never, ever underestimate them, ever. So these things are just printed in my DNA almost. So here's a hero of mine. He's going on and on about women in the bedroom and keeping pregnant and barefooted and all these things. And I'm like... Oh, my God, he was funny. But, I like Showtime. I love entertainment. And I think being a tennis player, you're a performer.
Right.
So I got that part. And I thought, you know what, Bobby, just go for it. But I'm going to tell you, I'm not letting you get under my skin, because I didn't want him to think he could like he did Margaret, because I didn't get to see the match against Margaret. I must tell you, through this American Master Series, I got to see it once. And I didn't realize how badly Margaret played. And I felt so sorry for her, because we've all been there. Every human being's been in these situations where you're not happy and you don't do well and you choke. I mean, athletes, we choke. I mean, champions just choke less. She had a horrible day at the office. So I felt so bad. But did tee us up, though. I must say it teed us up. The women's movement, Title IX the year before, all the things that I've been fighting for forever, equal opportunities for boys and girls. You know, it's funny because everybody talks about how this divided us. Actually, it brought everybody together. It did exactly what I wanted. It had all these parties, all these bets from people. Everybody was crazy at this time about this match.
Well, what I wanted to ask you was, do you think Bobby Riggs really held these strong beliefs about the role of women, or was this just basically shtick that he developed to get attention?
I think he was chauvinistic. I think he probably went over the top for the match, but he's a very kind person, but I think he's very chauvinist. I think he was chauvinistic, but a really nice chauvinist. And he and I remained friends up until the day he died from prostate cancer.
So the day the match arrives and Riggs enters accompanied by a bunch of young women, you enter like Cleopatra carried on a train of muscular guys. This is obviously
it.
Part of the show. Yeah, you felt okay about that?
Oh, yeah, I felt great because it's showtime. And Jerry Parenteau was quite sweet. You know, before I came out, he said, I have this Egyptian litter. Do you think you'd get in? I know you're a feminist. You probably won't. I said, are you kidding? It's showtime. This is perfect. Absolutely, I'll get up here. Let's have some fun. You know, the crowd deserves a good show. Obviously, I was about ready to die because I've got to win this match. I mean, the reality of it. But I also, you know, your fans always come first. So I said, no, I'll get on there. And he about fainted. He said, you will? I said, yes, of course I will. It's showtime.
Let's hear a little bit of showtime here. I want to listen to a little bit of Howard Cosell describing your entrance. Let's listen to this.
It's like Monday night football. It's not the usual tennis atmosphere. It's a happening.
And here comes Billie Jean King, a very attractive young lady. And if she ever let her hair grow down to her shoulders and took her glasses off, you'd have somebody vying for a Hollywood screen test. There she is.
And that's Howard Cosell reminding us it was 1973 when Billie Jean King played Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes. This whole thing, if you took your glasses off, you know, it's sort of remarkable to hear that.
It still prevails.
Still out there, huh?
Not to the extent, but it does.
Billie Jean King recorded in 2013. Now we're going to listen to an excerpt of the interview I recorded this month with tennis legend Billie Jean King. She has a new memoir called All In. Well, Billie Jean King, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Dave.
You didn't grow up in a country club. Your dad was a career firefighter. How did you pick up tennis and get good at it?
Well, it happened in fifth grade. First of all, I did play all team sports as a child, baseball, football. Basketball was our first love. And I have a younger brother, Randy Moffitt, who played 12 years of professional baseball. So he and I played sports together all the time. I'm 5 years older. I also remember at 9 years old, I realized as a girl, I couldn't play baseball. We were watching a Pacific Coast League in California when I was nine, and I realized that was I was really upset that day. I'll never forget realizing that because of my gender, I'm a girl, I'll never be able to play professional baseball. So anyway, in fifth grade, Susan Williams was sitting next to me. She looked at me and says, do you want to play tennis? And I go, tennis? What's tennis? I said, well, what do you do? And she says, you get to run, jump, and hit a ball. I said, oh, wow, I'm there. I'll try it. So we went to her country club. I loved it. And I thought, well, this is nice, but my dad's a firefighter. I'm never going to be able to play all the time because we don't belong to a country club, that's for sure. Then Susan and I are also on a softball team in Houghton Park, and she says to the coach, oh, I took Billy out to play tennis. And the coach, Val Halloran, says, oh, they give free instruction here every Tuesday at Houghton Park. And then I was excited. I might have a chance to really play. So my dad made me earn my first racket. I go out to the park, and I met Clyde Walker, my first coach. And I knew I wanted to be the number one tennis player in the world that day, the second time I picked up a racket.
So when you started playing, and you started playing competitively, and when you really got good and were kind of becoming known in junior tennis, I remember you describing when you would first started going to events at country clubs, you would notice that the boys, in a lot of cases, were having their meals comped, right? That wasn't coming your way.
Yes. At the Los Angeles Tennis Club, I used to sit back and watch what was going on, and the top male juniors could sign off on for sandwiches, Cokes. I was just talking to a friend the other day. She had the same situation. We used to take our brown bag lunches to the courts, and my mom and I would sit in the back and watch tennis and eat. But I always thought in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, it's really not right. Every should be by individual, not by whether you're a girl or a boy. So I was irritated. But when I was 12 was when I had my epiphany that really changed my life and set me on course. That was also at the Los Angeles Tennis Club. And I was sitting there daydreaming about my sport that I'd gotten into. And everybody wore white shoes and white socks and white clothes, played with white balls, and everybody who played was white. And I asked myself at 12 years old when I was daydreaming, where is everybody else? Where is everybody else? So I promised myself that day, if I could become number one, that I would fight for equality the rest of my life.
So let's talk about how you changed the game, or helped to change the game as a young woman. You know, you were an amateur back then, as most of the top tennis players were, and you would get some payments in the form of expenses, right? You called it shamateurism. Why was it a sham?
Because it's just dishonest. Sometimes, you know, you get money. The very officials that ran the game had tournaments and give whatever they decided to players, and they used to give more money to the foreign players. So that was another irritating fact. So we just knew the game had to change. It was a mess. It was a mess that wasn't honest. I liked integrity, really. Everything should start with integrity. And I felt like I'm in a sport that could do a lot better with that.
Even when you did get expenses, it wasn't a lot of money, right?
We got $14 a day when we stayed in housing.
Wow. So you began speaking out. You would talk to newspaper reporters, and this was after you'd established a name for yourself. You had defeated Margaret Smith at Wimbledon, I believe. And, you know, you were a known, well-known player, and you started giving these candid comments to reporters, calling this whole system shamateurism. And there's a moment you describe where Bob Kelleher, who I guess was the president of the Tennis Association, tells you, Billie Jean, if you don't stop giving all these interviews or you're going to get suspended, you just say, go ahead. You're like all of, 24 years old at the time. I mean, you you were kind of fearless about this, weren't you? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, it came from that epiphany when I was 12, but it also came from, I think, watching TV in the 50s and just seeing how you have to fight for change. Like, for instance, when kids of color, black kids, could not go to school with white kids. I did not understand that. I asked my dad and my mom, why? I don't understand that. And they said, oh, because they're Negroes. And I said, what does that got to do with it? And they said, because of their color. And I said, I don't get this. This isn't right. Also, Althea Gibson, who was the first black player ever to win a major, she was allowed to finally play in our tournaments in 1950. Of course, Jackie Robinson had joined the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. But finally, we had our champion and our Jackie Robinson of tennis. So I don't know. I just wanted things to be right. And also, I want people to change.
So there came a point at which tournaments were offering prize money finally. They didn't restrict these big tournaments to amateurs. Men were making much more than women, and you needed a way to assert your interests in real recognition and real pay. And somehow this idea came up of a tour, of you forming a women's tour. Explain what happened here.
It was a buildup of 3 years because in 68, when it went open, it was crazy. They started having less opportunities for us, like you said, dropping tournaments, giving us less. So Rosie Gonzalez and I talked to Gladys Hellman. Gladys Hellman was the publisher of World Tennis Magazine. So Gladys said she was trying to work with Jack Kramer at the Pacific Southwest, and it just got impossible. So she said, to hell with it, I'm going to do a tournament, which was great. So we have this tournament, but during the tournament, we would get together and have meetings. The three things that we talked about, there were three things that any girl born in this world, if she were good enough, would have a place to compete. Number two, she'd be appreciated for her accomplishments, not only her looks. And number three, to be able to make a living playing tennis, which was the most important thing, because most of us had obviously experienced our $14 a day. So we ended up signing a $1 contract with Gladys, and that was the birth of women's professional tennis the way you know it today. We didn't care if we're suspended, which we were. We were suspended, then we're taken back, suspended, taken back. It was very tumultuous at the time. It was very scary. We didn't know what was going to happen. But of course, now you see the WTA Tour with millions and millions of dollars. You see the winners of the majors making, you know, $3 million. You can go right back to that day when we signed that $1 contract. That is the essence of why they are getting this money today.
You are so candid and outspoken in so much of your life as an athlete. And you tell some stories about your personal life in the book where you carried a lot of secrets for understandable reasons. I mean, you were married to Larry King, not the broadcaster Larry King, but sounds like he was a really supportive partner of yours for a long, long time. But you developed a relationship with a woman, Marilyn Barnett, which you felt you had to keep this a secret. And I think given the day and given the stakes, that the way attitudes were at the time, it's not surprising given everything that you were doing that you did keep it a secret. But the relationship eventually soured. She occupied a house. She didn't want to move out of it. She was talking about selling letters you had written to her demanding money. And in the end, you tried to negotiate it quietly, but one day she, without warning, files a lawsuit outing your relationship. That certainly had to be one of the toughest days of your life. And you had to decide what to do. And lawyers and press folks would advise you, say as little as you can. Don't try the case in public. You chose a different course. You know, tell us what you did.
They wanted to kind of deny it. And I said, well, I can't deny it. I mean, it's a fact. I've had this affair with Marilyn. It'd been over quite a while when she finally sued me. And I don't know that in those days, the publicists would just say, it's private, it's none of your business, and it's not true. And I'm like, you guys, I can't do that. And I said, I want a press conference. And they said, no, no, no. So I fought with them for like 48 hours, and I said, I'm going to do it. And the place was packed as I thought it would be, and I told them the truth. You know, I just said I had an affair with Marilyn Barnett. You could hear a pin drop, and that was it. But it was a terrible time. And also, being gay or bisexual or whatever I thought I was at the time, trying to remember back what I was feeling in those days, that we still weren't accepted. We're still considered a deviant until 1975 or something. Psychiatry was saying we weren't healthy and well. And it took a long, long time for people, but also people on the tour who ran the tour told me if I said anything, we wouldn't have a tour. That made it real simple. I'm not going to go saying if I think I'm going to ruin the tour. Not after all we've been through and everybody else has been through. So that kind of put me deeper into the closet for sure. And then not being happy with myself, being shame-based, my parents being homophobic, all these things were just swirling around. I'm still trying to play tennis. Ugh, it's a mess. I was a mess. This was my toughest time, I think, in my life.
Right. And your parents did show up.
Oh, my parents were great. I knew they would show up. But for them to accept it, that took a long, long time. That took until the 90s. I got psychotherapy. I went to an eating disorder place. And so I think everyone has these moments in their lives that they know that it hasn't been just an easy road, that's for sure.
Well, you know, I had been aware of this event. But what I learned in the book was that, in fact, you know, while in a way you told the truth that in that you had had this affair, there was a lot that you were still not disclosing, right? I mean, you actually then had another relationship with Ilana Kloss, who you've remained with for all of these decades. But you kind of said this was it was a mistake. I was unfaithful to my marriage, and you said you're still committed to the marriage. And so, in fact, what you actually say in the book is that in this case, you turned being outed into a way to burrow deeper into the closet. I mean, you had to hide even more. That had to be really hard. Gosh.
Well, Larry and I did. We did.
Larry, your husband at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, Larry is my husband at the time. And we did try again. But I was already with Lana. I'd asked Larry for a divorce in 1969, and he said no. And he still didn't want to get divorced. He never did, actually. We finally got divorced in 87, I think. And he still didn't want to get divorced. It was one of the most painful moments in separations because we love each other. But I was with Ilana by now when this lawsuit happened. And we've been together for 42 years, and it's worked out unbelievable.
One more thing. You know, when Naomi Osaka chose not to talk to the media, I mean, you expressed an opinion about that. We also saw Simone Biles taking, you know, a mental health break during the Olympics. What's your take on cases like that where people think they need to step back from the spotlight for a time?
I think it's great. They're being honest and telling the world. And of course, with social media, it's a lot easier to share your thoughts quickly, can mobilize quickly, communicate quickly. No, I think we've always had these issues. I don't think people realize, like, the WTA, the Women's Tennis Association, has services for this, but it's confidential. So that's why no one's ever heard about it. A Naomi can go and get help. Get psychologists, we get whatever for them. So, and I think it's good Simone spoke up. I think she was smart to do that so the team could win a medal. I think that's the right thing to do.
Well, Billie Jean King, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Thanks, Dave. It's good talking to you.
Billie Jean King's new book is All In, an autobiography. 4 years ago, TV writer-producer David E. Kelly and actor Nicole Kidman teamed up for a successful HBO miniseries called Big Little Lies, based on the best-selling novel by Leon Moriarty. Now they've teamed up again for a new TV miniseries called Nine Perfect Strangers, based on Moriarty's 2018 novel. Kelly is the creator, Kidman is the star. It's now streaming on Hulu. Our TV critic David Biancooley has this review.
Leon Moriarty's novel Nine Perfect Strangers comes to television with the same basic ingredients and approach it had in print. It's part Agatha Christie-style drawing room mystery, with eccentric characters confined to one place and a recurring threat of murder lurking in the shadows. It's also part reality show, with each participant selected for specific reasons. Not only their own pasts, but for their personalities and how they can potentially react to and sometimes trigger the others. The setting is a remote, controversial New Age spa called Tranquillum House, a California retreat run by a spiritual, mysterious woman named Masha. With a Russian accent, a very slow and deliberate manner of talking, and an almost ethereal presence, she's played by Nicole Kidman. It's yet another deep and challenging role she's inhabited since opting to focus on TV miniseries as well as movies. Her other TV work includes not only a previous Moriarty TV adaptation of Big Little Lies, but also another excellent HBO drama, The Undoing. But Nine Perfect Strangers is more of an ensemble than a solo turn. And the nine strangers gathered by Masha for a concentrated dose of healing and of personal discovery are impeccably cast. David E. Kelly and John Henry Butterworth develop the novel for Hulu, and Jonathan Levine directs all 8 episodes. Hulu provided the first 6 for preview, and they're very entertaining. Michael Shannon from Boardwalk Empire plays one of the guests, a grieving father who's attending with his wife and daughter. And the two scene stealers are Melissa McCarthy and Bobby Cannavale. He plays Tony, a former pro athlete. She plays Frances, an author who gets a call from her agent while driving to the retreat, and it's bad news. She's just lost her contract with her publisher. She pulls off the road by a remote field and screams. But Tony, also heading to Tranquillum House, hears her and pulls over. This is where Nine Perfect Strangers kicks into high gear, and we're not even at the resort yet. Kelly, as a TV writer-producer of Ally McBeal, The Practice, and Boston Legal, won Emmys for both comedy and drama, and plays to both strengths here. And like Masha, Kelly and company have chosen their participants well. Bobby Cannavale is very funny here, like he's channeling his inner Ray Romano. And McCarthy is, well, Melissa McCarthy, which means she's hilarious.
Hello? You okay? Do you need some help, miss?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
You don't seem good.
Well, I was just having a quiet moment of despair.
Okay, well, that's your idea of a quiet moment? Because you seem... You're screaming like a banshee. That's why I pulled over.
Well, I'm sorry. I apologize. Okay. I thought I was in the middle of nowhere, completely alone. Clearly, that is not the case.
Are you sick?
I beg your pardon?
You seem to be having some kind of a mental breakdown episode sort of thing. I'm not judging. You know, I got mental illness in my own family.
Is that right? I'm fine.
You know, it's not normal to be screaming dead to the world at the top of your lungs, you know?
You know what it is? I was having a hot flash.
Oh.
So I'm good. Thank you so much.
Do you take supplements?
I'm sorry.
Progesterone? Progesterone. I heard that helps.
Are we actually having this conversation right now?
What's with the tone, lady?
I don't have a tone. I am just not used to complete strangers prescribing hormone replacement therapy. Curbside!
Apologies. I can see now that you're a tragic person. Have a good day.
Yet the characters, like the actors playing them, aren't here just for laughs. Once Frances arrives at the retreat and is ushered into her room, she bursts into tears and sobs, and becomes the first guest to encounter Nicole Kidman as Masha, who just sort of appears.
How did you get in here?
I came in through the door. I'm Masha.
You're her.
Why are you crying, Frances?
Oh, you know, it's a little bit of my career is over kind of thing. A bit of menopause. Makes in a little bad relationship. A dash of crippling shame.
We're gonna get you well.
You know, I almost didn't come. And then when I did get here, I really thought about leaving.
Nearly everyone here almost didn't come. They sense it's gonna take courage. And it'll be sometimes unpleasant. And I'll tell you something else. The people who come here, most of them, they have fairly good lives, comfortable even. They come for the suffering.
I don't want to suffer.
You're already suffering.
Masha's methods are very unorthodox. The daily smoothies have more potent ingredients in them than just fresh fruits and veggies, and the individual therapy sessions can be quite intense. But this miniseries is unorthodox as well. It can be very comic, then turn suddenly into sadness or tragedy. We get to know these guests, and even the counselors, but slowly, and partly through flashbacks that, like the interactions at the spa, take time to unravel. But for viewers, it's all time well spent.
David Bianculli is a professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey. He reviewed Nine Perfect Strangers. It's now streaming on Hulu. Coming up, we'll talk with Kenan Thompson. Nominated for an Emmy for his performances on Saturday Night Live, he's been with the show longer than any cast member in SNL history. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies. Terry Gross has the next interview. I'll let her introduce it.
My guest, Kenan Thompson, is nominated for 2 Emmys for his comedy performances on Saturday Night Live and for his starring role in his new NBC sitcom, Kenan. On Kenan, he plays the host of a local morning TV show in Atlanta. The show is all about advice, recipes, and cheerful talk, but he's still grieving the loss of his wife and is now a single father, raising his 2 young daughters, and finding it hard to devote enough time to his family while also hosting the show. It's been renewed for a 2nd season, and you can watch the 1st season free, streaming on NBC Peacock. Kenan Thompson won an Emmy in 2017 for co-writing the SNL song parody, Come Back, Barack. Thompson has been with SNL for 18 years, making him the performer with the longest tenure in the history of the show. Among the recurring sketches he's best known for are the game shows Black Jeopardy and What's Up With That. Some of the characters he's played over the years include Steve Harvey, Al Sharpton, O.J. Simpson, Charles Barkley, and Bill Cosby. Thompson played Fat Albert, one of the characters Cosby created, in the live-action adaptation of the Fat Albert animated series. Cosby voiced the character himself in the animated series. Thompson has had a TV career since he was a child. Kenan Thompson, welcome to Fresh Air. It is great to have you on our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a clip from an episode of Black Jeopardy, because that's always so funny. And this is a very special episode of Black Jeopardy that I want to play because it features Chadwick Boseman as the guest contestant.
Mm-hmm.
And for any listeners not familiar with this recurring sketch, could you just explain the premise of Black Jeopardy?
I mean, it's basically in the title, you know. It's the black version, like if Jeopardy was hosted and produced by a mostly black, you know, situation, basically. And it's just to lean into that, you know.
Okay. So here's an episode of Black Jeopardy with, of course, Kenan Thompson hosting. And the contestants are Chris Redd, Leslie Jones, and Chadwick Boseman, but in the role that he plays in Black Panther, T'Challa.
All right, Rashad, it's your pick.
All right, let's go with All Hell Nah for 400.
All right, the answer, the airline says they want to charge $25 to check your bag. Shanice.
What is All Hell Nah? Looks like I'm going to fly to Jamaica with a 50-pound suitcase in my lap.
Yeah, you're damn right. You're damn right. That's right. And I dare the stewardess to say something. That's right. Let's keep going.
Let's stay with grown ass for 600.
All right. You send your smart ass child here because she thinks she grown. T'Challa.
What is to one of our free universities where she can apply her intelligence and perhaps one day become a great scientist?
Okay, well, the answer we was looking for was out my damn house. But you know what? I'm gonna give it to you, T'Challa. Y'all must not have no mean streets in Wakanda. All right, the board is yours.
Very well. Let's go to Ah Hell Nah for 800.
Okay. The policeman says there's been some robberies in your neighborhood and asks if you have any information.
What is... Not only do I tell this man what I know, but I also assist him in tracking down the offender. After all, our ministers of law enforcement are only here to protect us. Is this correct?
I mean, it should be. But I'm thinking you haven't spent much time in America. Let's just hear about today's prizes. Johnny?
So that was an episode of Black Jeopardy hosted by my guest, Kenan Thompson. That is
my
so much
goodness.
Fun. Yeah, and then, of course, listening back to Chadwick Boseman, that must bring back memories for you.
Absolutely. I mean, that was such an electric week in general, you know, like the king, Chadwick, was just blessing us with his grace, number one, because Black Panther was the biggest thing going at the time, and you know, he contributed and gave all of his efforts and energy to our show like he did anything else while he was promoting, you know, a movie of that caliber. It was just unbelievable to witness, let alone being able to do like one of my, you know, beloved sketches, you know, with him in very close proximity and stuff. It was just, it was great. I was close proximity with him that whole episode. Like, we did a monologue together where I just, you know, thought I had a good idea to play Panthro from... the Thundercats back in the day. So we had built a full Panthro costume. It was the most ridiculous thing in the world, but I had fun, and You know, he was committed to that too. So the thing about Black Jeopardy that week where we were trying to figure out exactly how to make his, you know, elevate from Tom Hanks, who had just, you know, destroyed it the last time. So it was an uphill battle, but we got there and he stayed, you know, in it with us. He never like got mad or frustrated or, you know, just like going back and forth idea wise in the wrong direction or anything like that. He just trusted us to kind of find it, and we did. And, you know, all the credit to him, you know, he performed the hell out of it.
He knew he was sick at the time, that he had cancer. Did you know that?
Absolutely not.
Not. And so what was your reaction when you later found out that you were working with him when he was actually very sick?
It just floored me. Like, the whole thing, you know, it was just a crazy few months, you know, with, like, him and Kobe. And, like, man, it was, like, a lot of things just coming out of, you know, left field. But the fact that he was working so hard and he was so focused, because in between, you know, rehearsal takes and stuff like that, he was like practicing karate moves, you know what I'm saying? So he was always like looking like he had other things to do and stuff like that. Like, as far as living is concerned, you know, I never saw him coughing or anything like that, you know? So him being, you know, of ill health was the furthest thing from my mind. If anything, it looked like he just needed maybe a vacation at some point, but a super baller one, because he was on top of the world.
Yeah. So let's go to 2017. You won an Emmy that year for Outstanding Original Music and Lyrics.
Yes.
For the song Come Back Barack, which was, why don't you describe what the video is like? This is like a song parody.
Yeah, it was, you know, reminiscent of the old school 90s kind of R&B era with, you know, the Jodeci's and, you know, Silks and All for Ones of the world and 112 and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, slow jams, you know, big silky suits and canes and hats and sunglasses and slow motion walks and fans and, you know, deep voices trying to entice the other side of the spectrum to maybe have a wonderful wonderful evening in the bedroom somewhere or something, but we happened to be singing to Barack Obama to come back to the White House. So,
right, and so we're going to hear an excerpt of this, and we're going to hear Chance the Rapper singing lead. Chris Redd is one of the singers, and we're going to hear you doing like the monologue in the middle of the song. Who did you think about doing a monologue in the song?
It was like, you know, kind of, I think Boyz II Men used to do it. So they had a very deep voice, you know, a guy, I think his name is Mike, and he would always take a moment and be like, girl, you know what I'm saying? Let's take a moment and like just slow it down, slow it down. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. So this is Come Back Barack from Saturday Night Live.
Come back Barack.
Come on, man, we're out in the rain.
Don't leave us here alone.
It's definitely too cold to be rained
on.
I mean, I know you're busy with that library and everything.
The White House ain't a home.
Well, Trump don't even got a dog, man.
Just come back, Barack.
You know, it's been a long time, Barack. Almost as long as since a guy talked over a record like this. Why would you leave us? Oh, because you had to. Because of the Constitution. But you can come back, right? Oh, you can't. Because that would undermine the very institutions that we barely holding on to as it is. I see. I guess we stuck with this dude for a while then. Maybe you can come back and make a speech. How much would that cost? For real? Oh, no, we definitely can't afford that. So I'm just getting rained on for nothing. That's interesting. Well, you enjoy your retirement, homie.
Come back, Barack.
Get shade.
We need you all so bad.
Super bad.
2020's looking sad.
Maybe Michelle could run.
Like really sad, like super sad. What the hell we gonna do, sad?
Let's not put Michelle through that. Hilarious.
What was the music you grew up with?
I grew up with my parents playing a lot of Motown and, you know, soul music and stuff. Gospel, of course, and, you know, Southern hip hop, basically. So a whole lot of Outkast.
Yeah, and you grew up in Atlanta, where Outkast is from.
Exactly. They went to my high school. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We're always very proud of that at our school.
So you did a couple of things for Nickelodeon, and then you did the live-action adaptation of the animated series Fat Albert, based on characters originated by Bill Cosby, and he voiced Fat Albert in the original animated series. What did you like about the character? Like, describe the character for anyone who's not familiar with him.
Fat Albert's just a big, jolly leader of the gang, you know, and he's all about, this is the guy the lessons come through. So whatever the lesson is, the episode is about, you know, Fat Albert would be the leader of, you know, helping to discover and bring to light for those characters that need to learn something, whatever it is they need to learn, mixed with music, you know. And Cosby was just like one of those go-to, like, feel-good American dad kind of destinations when I was growing up. So to get a chance to play the, you know, iconic character, you know, Fat Albert's a big character in the culture. I think FUBU had just finished doing their line of, like, Fat Albert character clothing and stuff like that, and it did really well because it was such a retro kind of thing that everybody loved from their childhood and stuff like that. So it just felt like, you know, an opportunity to do something big for the culture.
Were you close with Bill Cosby when you were doing Fat Albert?
Not necessarily close, but, you know, he was a very busy man. So when he was around, he was very engaging and open and stuff like that. But he was only around like 3 times. So I didn't get to spend much time with him. But promoting the movie, he was, you know, he brought me to the Apollo to open for him once. That was my first time, like, being at the Apollo and stuff like that. And in Philly, we were doing, like, interviews and stuff like that together when we had the premiere for the movie. So he was available when he was available. But no, I didn't spend much time with him.
What did you do when you opened for him?
I made a fool out of myself. Basically, like, tell people where the exit doors were instead of doing jokes. Like, I didn't have any jokes. I'm not a stand-up. So I just felt like a real fish out of water. But basically just getting everybody psyched to see Bill Cosby. And then he would go out and perform for 3 hours wearing a sweater with my face on it, like a Fat Albert sweater. It was crazy.
How did you feel when you found out about the roofies and how he sexually assaulted women? What was that like for you?
I mean, I'm sure nothing in comparison to, like, the people that were really affected by it, but it definitely didn't feel good to be close to any kind of behavior like that. So I wanted, you know, whatever justice that could be served, but yeah, the whole thing just felt gross, you know what I mean? It felt gross to be in such a close proximity to that. But I was proud of the work that me and my castmates did on that movie because we spent a lot of time together and we had a great time, you know? It was a lot of work, but we got through it together, like, through laughter and just us being close and young and good people. So I was still proud of the movie, but definitely kind of devastated that it had this, you know, shadow around it now.
You were not the person who was assaulted, but did you still feel betrayed by him? You know, you had looked up to him.
Oh, absolutely. I felt the exact betrayal.
You know, he was just a father figure for so many people.
1,000%. I felt like a heavy betrayal, basically, because, you know, he was, you know, the guy when I was growing up, he was like the one clean comic, so, you know, I watched Bill Cosby himself thousands of times. Like, he was basically my introduction to what comedy was and what sitcoms were and all that kind of thing. And then, like, learning his history and his career. And, you know, he's like the first probably autobiography that I read and stuff like that. So, yeah, he was a prime example of a career that I wanted to have. And, you know, the kind of guy I thought I wanted to be as far as, like, being a father and being a comedian is concerned and stuff like that. And then you hear rumors about, you know, when Eddie Murphy came out and said that he wasn't, you know, treating Eddie Murphy right. And, you know, Eddie was like, well, I want to be my own person. Like, you know, whatever. You let that wash off your back. And then you hear rumors of this and that and the other as time goes by. And it's like, all right, well, I guess he's got weird stuff going on or whatever. Like, but, you know, it's in the court's hands. I guess they're capable people. Like, whatever is happening, it's happening, and they'll find out exactly, you know, how to go about it. Let me mind my business type of thing. But then it gets to the point where real allegations and real numbers, like, start coming out, and that's when it's, like, unavoidable, and the outcome is, you know, the present outcome and the present reality that we live in. And it just sucks, man. It really sucks. I felt super betrayed for being such a big fan and, you know, idolizing somebody who was, you know, entrenched in what they were entrenched in.
So you got to play Bill Cosby in a very funny sketch in which Cosby is in prison. So the premise is you're alone in your cell when the prison guard brings in a new prisoner who is going to be your new cellmate. And the new prisoner is played by Seth Meyers. So let's hear a clip from this sketch, and Seth Meyers as the new prisoner speaks first.
So what are you in here for?
You don't ask a man that in here. You put your head down. Keep to your business.
Wow, old timer, you really know the ropes. I've never done time before. This friggin' sucks.
Hey! You don't come in here with your filth and your foul, foul filth. You need to get a job.
Hey, Cosby, keep it down. This is the 10th warning and you've only been here 4 days. Lights on!
Wow. Bill Cosby, I mean, on behalf of every one of your fans, it is so disappointing to be meeting you now.
What? I am in my prime. I'm in jail and loving it. No kids with the darndest things. Limited interactions with Camille. And when I was fighting incarceration, I had no idea that one of the staple foods of the prison system is Jell-O.
So that's a sketch from Saturday Night Live from 2018 with my guest Kenan Thompson as Bill Cosby and Seth Meyers as his new cellmate. How did you feel about playing Cosby in prison?
It was just so crazy, you know? Like, it was kind of like playing OJ. I don't take pleasure from it, but, you know, our job is to kind of reflect our realities, basically. And the reality is Bill Cosby was in jail, or there's a guy named OJ back walking the streets and going to dinner with people, you know? So it was one of those things, like, you know, it's kind of part of our job as opposed to, like, oh, this is something I'm excited about doing.
Well, Kenan Thompson, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
An absolute pleasure. I can't believe you listened to all of that.
Kenan Thompson speaking with Terry Gross. He's nominated for 2 Emmys for his comedy performances on Saturday Night Live and for his starring role in his sitcom, Kenan. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.